There are barriers you can see, but then there's the ones you can't see. The ones that hide in our assumptions about what accessibility means and who it's really for. In this episode, we're digging into those hidden barriers. The ones that come from the things we don't question. The beliefs and ideas about disability that shape everything around us. From the design of our homes to the policies that govern them. And we'll ask, how do these barriers show up in community housing and beyond? What would it take to shift these beliefs? And could community housing be the starting point for a larger cultural change? I'm Megan Miller.
I'm Zachary Weeks.
And this is
Accessing Home.
Somebody could say, oh, yeah, we're barrier free. Oh, okay. That's great. Oh, your washrooms are on the second floor. Oh, okay. Or, oh, yeah, it's only just one step up. I think people need to be open to realizing that when they come up with plans without consultation, there will always be a, oh, welcome to our grand opening. We're going to fix that in 3 weeks and then it'll be okay. Like, accessibility doesn't need to be an afterthought. It can just be an accepted part of the building plan.
This is Carrie Tashuk.
I live in Edmonton in the Art Space Housing Cooperative, and I have been living with MS for 19 years, and moving to Art Space was a consideration based on what my disease is and the likely path that my disease will take. My last residence was a beautiful two-bedroom, two-bathroom. I needed to stop living there because I needed to walk up 4 steps from the sidewalk to get into the building and then walk up another 3 steps to get on the main level of the building. And how my MS had affected my walk and my mobility. It's like, I do not need an obstacle course every day.
Carrie has lived in Art Space for over 9 years, and during this time, he's been in 2 different units. He moved into his current place back in 2023, and so far, it's been a good fit.
Yeah, this was a newly renovated unit that I moved into. I have a barrier-free shower. It's just got a little tiny rubber dam that I step over, and other members who have them, their commode chairs can easily go over without tipping or capsizing or whatever. My kitchen is, all the counter heights are 30 inches and there's space. I do not use a chair at this time. I get around mostly with walker and or cane, but I have seating. I've got an office chair in my kitchen so I can sit and wash dishes, cook. Everything in my place is at a workable, functional level.
As you might recall, Art Space was designed with accessibility in mind. A third of the units are adapted for wheelchair users. And while the building isn't perfect, one of the reasons many residents have been satisfied is that the co-op's management is open to feedback. They actively listen to members and use that input to make improvements. A great example is when Carrie did a walkthrough of his new unit.
Walking through with the property manager, I said, so my old kitchen had this, and this doesn't have built-in pantry space. This is new storage, but it's on top of the wall oven, and I can get to it. I shouldn't get to it because I don't do so well on ladders. But keeping in mind, many people who live here are coupled. And the co-op does have a program called SAIL, which is an acronym for Support for Art Space Independent Living. So there are healthcare aides that come and provide services, well, cooking, toileting, housekeeping, the healthcare type things. So a very tall, 7 foot off the ceiling shelf would be great for someone to put the thing that I don't use except for once a year and then say, oh, can you get that down? Thank you. There's another unit that is just about finished its renovation. And from our walk through here, they took some ideas down and implemented in that floor plan, which is just a different kitchen layout. And for the member that's moving in, she uses a power chair and it will just be even better for her.
We've discussed how the flexibility of community housing to meet residents' needs often hinges on funding, and ArtSpace is no exception.
There's beautiful, amazing things that are happening, and we need to, of course, be realistic and say, so our nonprofit organization that runs the co-op is going to keep that in mind. We're going to see what we can do.
But funding isn't the only factor. At ArtSpace, accessibility is a core value, but that's the exception, not the rule, even in community housing. At this point, I think it's important to take a step back and consider how society understands disability, because that affects our approach to accessibility. And while there are many frameworks for disability, there are two that stand out: the medical model and the social model.
Just to clarify, the medical model focuses on the fact that, oh, you're disabled, you need to adapt to the world. There's an issue with you, and it's your job to fix it, whether it's through physiotherapy or surgery or, you know, just too bad, too sad. Social model of disability is one that I follow, in that it's not what's wrong with you, it's what's wrong with the environment, what's wrong with society. So we need to adapt these areas to help you thrive.
This distinction between the medical and social models isn't just theoretical. It has real, everyday consequences. Because when we view disability through the medical model, as a personal problem to be fixed or overcome, disabled people are treated as the problem. They're blamed for not being able to navigate a world that was never built with them in mind. And that leads to pity, exclusion, or pressure to overcome. But the social model flips that script. Instead of asking, what's wrong with you, it asks, why aren't buildings accessible? Why don't workplaces offer flexible schedules? Who decided what counts as normal anyway? And that systems approach helps reveal something deeper. Because these barriers aren't random. They're shaped by the ideology of ableism, the assumption that disabled people are inherently less valuable, less capable, and less deserving of respect than non-disabled people.
It is very deeply rooted in our society. There's also something called internalized ableism, in which, you know, for example, I dealt with for a long time and still do, because of what society impressed upon me at a young age, that, you know, I would never be able to get married. I would never be able to get a job. I would never be able to have sex. Never be able to, right? All these never, never, never. Or even just, yeah, apologizing for needing to use the washroom with a caregiver. Oh, I need to go pee, sorry. Why are you saying sorry? Like, we all take a whiz. It's no big deal, right? But it's so ingrained in one's mind that they are an inconvenience, that they are a burden to society. Maybe it's just because I'm Canadian, we apologize for everything. But if you're told something, sooner or later, you're going to believe it. You know, I grew up in a time when it was like physiotherapy and surgeries. We're gonna make you walk, you know, by doing this surgery and that surgery. But they were selling me a goods and services that wasn't true, damn it. But it was a valiant try. And while those certainly have a place in today's world, you know, because medical advancements are awesome, and I'm all for it, and I wouldn't be here without it. You know, we need to get away from what's wrong with that person and what's wrong with the world.
Ableism reinforces rigid ideas about how our bodies and minds should function, and in turn, creates stigma not just towards disability, but also towards the tools and aids associated with it. Here's Carrie again.
9 years ago, 10 years ago, I met with a ET and an OT, and I'd been walking with a cane. I was very much a splayed tripod as I navigated. I would get tired after walking a block and would need to sit. And at the clinic, she said, "What other equipment have you tried?" And I'm like, "None." And she's like, "I've got some walkers here." And just knowing that I could stand more straight and I could correct my gait, so my feet were like, oh, shoulder width apart, rather than as stretched out as I'd been before, I'm just like, sign me up. This conserves my energy, gives me a place to sit if I need. I've got a carrying basket. My dad, 84 years old, had hip replacement surgery. I do not think he did the PT that was necessary. And his alignment of his hip is at such an angle that when he walks, I notice he drags that foot, and he's still active. But I know that if he had a walker, it would help straighten things out and make things easier and smooth. They've got a ramp at their house anyway.
Accessibility aids exist to help people live more independently, yet they're often avoided or seen as a last resort. Not because they don't help, but because they make disability visible. And because disability is so often framed as something negative or undesirable, anything that signals disability takes on that same stigma. Many people would rather struggle silently than face the social costs associated with disability.
Yeah, the micro-ableism that comes with it, whether it's the eye rolls of, you know, oh, you need an elevator? Let me get up and show you where the elevator is. And I was like, oh, like, I don't mean to be a pain in the ass, but you're also being a little bit of a turkey. You know, it's not like I wanted to go out of my way to get you off your chair so you can show me or have you think about where the elevator is, or the size, or the, you know, and it does a number on one's mental health. I'd venture a guess that 90% of people with disabilities have mental health struggles. And how could we not?
Let's be real. If this were just about a few rude people, it'd be easier to fix. But these aren't isolated incidents. They're part of something much bigger. Because ableism doesn't just live in individual attitudes. It's built into systems. It shows up in how spaces are designed, how policies are written, and who gets considered and who doesn't. And the hardest part is that it's often invisible to the people who aren't affected by it, because ableism is subtle. It's normalized. Sometimes it shows up as paternalism, assuming disabled people can't do things for themselves. Sometimes it's condescension wrapped in praise, like calling someone inspirational for doing something ordinary, an everyday task. And sometimes it's outright exclusion. But no matter what form it takes, the impact is the same. It limits people's autonomy, dignity, and participation.
You know, I've had strangers say things to me. I had one bus driver yell at me saying, "You should be going off the bus backwards." I said, "And you are a cerebellar injury expert from..." And I'm just surprised that some people... I was listening to my AirPods once, and this woman said, "You should be listening to music if you're disabled, if you're working with your walker." I said, "Where do you teach physiotherapy?" My occupational therapist said, "Well, if you walk and turn the music, you can walk faster." It's a 100 gait. So there. But our neighbor here, he went out on one of the nice days. He's in a wheelchair. He said somebody purposely drove by and splashed him in the puddle, and they were all laughing at him. Let's hope that's minority. I believe that's minority.
This is Ian Young.
I'm a 61-year-old man living here in Edmonton. I became permanently disabled at the age of 41. And it was kind of an epiphany for me to see the life people have to live with disabled, the choice that they have to be just to survive. I really don't think it's right in a very rich province, in a very wonderful country, how people just slip through the cracks and everything seems to be very tedious and really not fair. So I've always been raised to speak the truth and be outspoken.
Ian has a rare disability affecting his cerebellum, the part of the brain responsible for balance, coordination, and some cognitive and emotional functions.
It's close to multiple sclerosis, and I had suffered 7 strokes. Don't ask me how a stroke feels, because I don't know, because I just lose different abilities every day. So I was bedridden for over a year without being able to talk, walk, speak, or even eat. I have a feeding tube installed. And then because of the province of Alberta, one day they just came in and loaded me up and everything. Didn't even let my family know. The nurses were in shock. I was being taken to a long-term care geriatric dementia ward. Which bankrupted me because it was private. I had to pay for it. I was physically and mentally abused there. When I was released from there and got into the Glenrose Hospital, they diagnosed me with PTSD from that experience.
What Ian experienced, being removed from medical care and forced into an abusive institution, isn't just a personal tragedy. It's part of a long, well-documented history of systemic ableism. And here in Alberta, that history includes a particularly dark chapter. Eugenics programs, forced sterilizations, and policies built on the belief that some lives are less valuable than others. And that history isn't over. Even today, many disabled people are still funneled into underfunded, unsafe facilities, just like Ian was. But despite the trauma he endured, Ian found a way to reclaim his life and his voice. He became a disability advocate with the Council of Canadians with Disabilities, started writing for his community paper, and about 18 years ago, he moved into ArtSpace Co-op.
I am not an accessible suite because I just had to move in here fast. Well, they asked me if I wanted accessible seats. I know I'll leave that for the people I need, because I do everything standing up. I may need it one day, but at the present time, I don't understand what to do.
While his unit isn't ideal for his mobility needs, Ian doesn't care, because accessibility isn't just about the building for him. It's also about autonomy, dignity, and community.
A lot of supported living places do won't let you decorate like I have my place here. But cooperatives are great because everybody can participate. We all make decisions on our own. And that does come down to accessibility. When I first moved in here, one of the first things I observed was the garbage recycling room did not have a proper button to get in. And I was like a new member, and I said, "Me, excuse me, And then a principal at the time took me, because I never noticed that. I said, "How many things you never noticed will happen to you?" That's a brilliant idea. I remember one girl in the elevator said to me, "Big mouth. Now you're going to give a lot of people nothing to complain about."
The beauty of co-ops is how they're community-driven. Members directly impact decisions. But as Ian points out, it's not just about having a seat at the table. It's also about who's listening and how they view the world.
We have no office manager. And people don't like her. Oh, she's nosy. I adore her. I have carpeting in here for 17 years. And carpet's not good for people that are wheels. It's like walking through the sand. She came to deliver me something. So I have carpet. I said, I was trying for 17 years to get rid of it. She was downstairs an hour later. It explodes in her career for blah, blah, blah. And 1 week, I was all done.
That's awesome. Yeah, again, people who care.
People care and people listen. That's why I believe in meetings, board meetings, so a bunch of us are on the same page and we educate each other. And I can count anything, simply planning anything. But you'll notice if you came in the front, across the street, we almost turn on to, well, it just put in a very up-to-standard ramp. Before it was awful. It was very steep. One person who lived here said, "Well, why bother? People in wheelchairs don't go down to the house. Anyway," I said, "Are you ever? How dare you say something like that? You know, probably glad they didn't. Because they couldn't. But if you live here, you see people in wheelchairs. You've got the disability, not me." Because disability can be a way of thinking, too.
I don't want to oversimplify things by claiming that community housing, like cooperatives, is the answer to ableism. It's obviously not. Ableism can show up anywhere, even in spaces designed with accessibility in mind. But what co-ops often do well is put decision-making in the hands of the people who actually live there. And that matters, because when it comes to accessibility, the people who know best are those who experience barriers every day. And they need to be part of shaping the systems and spaces that are meant to support them. That's the principle behind Nothing About Us Without Us, a core idea in disability justice. Decisions about disabled people's lives and access must include disabled people. Otherwise, those decisions miss the mark.
Everybody has a different accessibility. You have to be the modern medium. And the best way to make a difference is to talk to the people that are affected by it. I'm not saying pave over the oceans and the roadways. Let me go shopping. Let me get on a bus. Let me do things that are a human right. So if I can get from my place to your place without any roadblocks, and I call that accessible.
This isn't just about checking boxes or meeting building codes. Compliance is the baseline, but accessibility is a moving target. It evolves. That's why we can't settle for the minimum. We need to design with a mindset of continuous improvement.
Yeah, it's always going to be a work in progress, very similar to every other thing. We don't design buildings the way we did in the 60s or whatever. You know, there's better safety involved. There's higher safety requirements. Same thing with the accessibility. It's on a continual growth curve, hypothetically. And so we need to not just meet the mark, we need to excel so that we don't have to meet the mark again in another 5 years. You know, build it for 10 years, 20 years. And again, just we're not all rolling around in the same Fords back in 1905 that Henry Ford said, okay, that's it. We're not working on this car anymore.
You got the one color black, you're good.
Yeah, and four wheels.
Yeah.
And maybe a steering wheel. Yeah, we need to mindfully work to always elevate our game and now I sound like a hockey player, but we need to strive for better, always.
But what's wild is that we do strive for better, just unevenly. Because when it comes to things like airbags in cars or central heating in homes, no one argues that they're too expensive to justify. The value of these innovations are assumed, and so they're built in from the start. But when it comes to accessibility, suddenly it's treated as optional. So instead of being part of the central design, it's an add-on. And when access is an afterthought, it sends a quiet but powerful message that some people matter more than others.
And that's where I think we need to actually get away from the accessible housing terminology. You think of the wealthy, right? Which is neither you nor I. You know, they always want luxury, right? Oh, I want a walk-in shower. Well, let's bake a roll-in shower into housing. And no, that's not a wheelchair accessible shower. That's just a walk-in shower, barrier-free. You know, so we need to flip the script on how we describe these things, because, you know, even when, if we look at our seniors population, for example, they are very stubborn folks, very prideful, which is great. And a lot of seniors say, oh, I don't need the accessible suite. Keep that for little Zachary then, that needs his wheelchair accessible suite. It's like, it's there for you too, right? Having designated wheelchair accessible housing is great, but I think we need to get rid of the label and just get away from these unintentional biases. We need to essentially make accessibility mainstream. Right, everybody wearing glasses. Both you and I are wearing glasses. Technically, that's a disability, right? But we don't think of wearing glasses as a disability.
We need to reframe accessibility as something universal, not a special accommodation, but the standard. Because when environments work for everyone, that's not just inclusion, that's good design. I wish there was one simple fix to all of this, but there isn't. Education matters, awareness matters, but ableism isn't just about ignorance. Because even when we see the barriers, nothing changes. And that's because these systems were never neutral. They were built to favor certain bodies and minds and to exclude others. Capitalism rewards economic productivity above almost everything. And that productivity depends on a very narrow idea of the ideal worker. Someone who can work long hours at a consistent pace without breaks or accommodations. Someone who's seen as able-bodied, physically and mentally. And anyone who doesn't fit that mold is considered disruptive and costly. So they're excluded from paid employment and positioned as dependent. And the thing is, once you're labeled dependent, the system decides you're only worth the bare minimum, if that. Not long ago, the government of Alberta announced that it would claw back the new Canadian Disability Benefit, or CDB. The CDB is a $200 monthly payment from the federal government meant to support Canadians with disabilities. But instead of letting recipients keep that additional help, Alberta reduced AISH by the same amount, $200, effectively canceling out the benefit. So Albertans on AISH aren't receiving more. They're being denied the new support. And what's especially frustrating is that Alberta hasn't clawed back other federal benefits. So this move feels targeted. It feels like another way disabled people are being singled out and treated unfairly. And that $200 might not sound life-changing to some, but for people living on AISH, which already falls below the poverty line, it could have made a real difference. It could have helped someone cover rent, stay housed, live with just a little more stability and dignity. And this is about money, but it's also not about money. It's about who our systems value and who they punish.
And so we need to have open and honest, and quite frankly, it's going to be uncomfortable conversations about all things, whether it's racism or homophobia or ableism. And yeah, there are tons of microaggressions, especially with, well, when you look at disability, for example. Always having to be polite. Don't talk about the person's disability. No, it's who I am. And it's almost like an injustice to not bring it forward in a way, right? Like, because you're not fully accepting that person for who they are, right? And where they've come from and their history and their knowledge, and challenges and everything that go along with it. So yeah, the stigma still exists that, you know, we are to be pitied, we are less than, we are not able to, but screw that noise. Some of the smartest people in the world were the most disabled, if you check yourself. Stephen Hawking, I mean, that guy was a badass. Smartest guy in the world. I will say, you know, I'll end with, while we've had a very honest and quite frankly, parts of it depressing conversation, I want to remind people that I still believe in the human race as being well-intentioned. I think the intentions are there. We just need to help educate each other on how to help each other and take care of each other.
True accessibility isn't about goodwill or tweaking designs. It's about dismantling the barriers and backing people up with resources, making sure disabled people have the income and support they need to live with dignity. And if there's one thing to take away from all of this, I think Ian says it best.
Housing, of course, is the issue. They always talk about affordable housing, but they leave out the other way, accessible, affordable housing. Because a big, huge percentage of disabled people live in poverty. But housing is a human right. Listen to us. Listen to the experts. And yeah, use the two double words, accessible, affordable.
Changing minds is important, but shifting social norms, that's slow, generational work. And the truth is, we can't afford to wait for that kind of change. People need accessible homes now, and they need homes that they can actually afford. Community housing is one of the most promising solutions we have, but it can't carry the weight alone. Widespread change is needed. And that's where legislation comes in. Policy can't replace community-driven solutions, but it can create the framework and support needed to make accessibility the norm. So next time, we'll explore how we can set new standards and make sure accessibility is treated as a right, not a privilege. Accessing Home is created by me, Megan Miller, and is supported by Community Housing Canada, a research partnership funded by the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. My research is also supported by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council and the Royal Canadian Geographical Society. Music in this episode is from Blue Dot Sessions, a repository of free music for podcasters. An end credit song is Hard Living by John Bartman from freemusicarchive.org. Big thank you to Carrie Tashuk and Ian Young for speaking with me in this episode. And thanks to Amanda Twillos for giving the gift of the podcast visuals and CJSR 88.5 FM for the use of their studios. I'm Megan Miller.
I'm Zachary Weeks.
Thanks for listening.